Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2016. Lecture 22, delivered on April 7, 2016. The title of this lecture is The Capital Asset Pricing Model.
Today, the Capital Asset Pricing Model. I've talked about this before, and I've even, I think, shown you the formula, but this is the lecture where I formalize it. And I'm going to take you through some of the actual data that we use to calculate returns, expected returns, based upon betas using the capital asset pricing model, otherwise known as the CAPM. I'm going to show you a website where you can get some real good insights that help you to understand beta better, but also to understand what the CAPM can do looking forward to what's going to happen with the economy. Now, this website I'll show you here in just a little bit. And I won't tell the URL. That'll really frustrate the hell out of the people who like to blow off class the last day of the week. So, but to begin this process, we're going to just go right to the heart of the matter. If you look back at the history of intellectual ideas, oftentimes, well, not often, but you'll find these times in human history where something happens that converges thinking on an idea. Several different groups or individuals will come up with the same idea at the same time. And enlightenment sort of pops up after in different places. A great example of that would have been the calculus. It's always attributed to Sir Isaac Newton. He invented the calculus. That's actually not true. There were several who came to it at about the same time. And there is still, well, maybe not to this day, but there was certainly some bitterness that Newton, who was better known than others, was given the credit for what was being found at different places. Going back even further, interestingly enough, the calculus was almost figured out by the ancient Greeks, several of them. I believe it was Archimedes, was right on the verge of figuring it out. If he had, we would have had a very different history of the Western civilization after that. But they, at that time, they just could not overcome this wall that kind of held on until Newton's time. But anyway, there was this kind of convergence of different people figuring out, calculus. Certainly the same thing came about with the capital asset pricing model. There were several groups coming to it at the same time. In 1961, it was almost laid out in a monograph, an unpublished monograph by a financial economist, I think he was an economist, named Traynor. But then in September of 1965, William Sharpe, wrote the capital asset pricing model, published it in a paper. Not too many months later, I think it was February of the next year, another paper, which had been submitted about the same time as Sharpe's, was published by Lintner. And sometimes you'll hear the capital asset pricing model called the Sharpe CAPM or the Sharpe Lintner CAPM. And then there was a guy right after that, Mawson, I think his name was, something like that. He came up. He had pushed a paper out to get it published. So there was this convergence on the understanding of risk assets, how we can determine the discount rate to apply to them. It's the capital asset pricing model. It's a very simple model. Now, understand that the difference, and you might have been introduced to this someplace along the line, the difference between a theory and a model. CAPM is a model. It is buttressed, backed by portfolio theory. But it is a model, and it is a model that works fabulously well, considering all the competing models that could be out there. And it has survived now for about a half century, I'll be darned. There are some theories that stand the test of time and the models that go with the theories. A good example of that would be the theory of relativity and the modeling of relativistic phenomena. It has survived over 100 years, been tested, and every prediction it makes comes out by God, right spot on. The theory of gravity, Newton, stays right there, its current, to this day, several centuries after it was put forward, modeling everything from how planets go around stars to how objects fall off tables. There are other models that really don't have much of a theory behind them, or the theory and the model just aren't very well connected. That doesn't mean the model sucks, but it is always suspect and considered kind of less than a model that comes from a theory that is strong and keeps getting tested and proving itself right. A good example of a model that is very shaky is the quantum mechanics model. Quantum theory might be fairly strong, but the quantum model just keeps having to have new things slapped on it every time they see something that they weren't expecting. So it's kind of a shaky model. However, it will produce results that will affect your life. It's just that sometimes a model from a theory is much stronger. CAPM is one of those. Capital asset pricing model. There are other models that compete with it. In an MBA course or in a more advanced finance course, if you take more finance, you might be introduced to one of the other models that competes with CAPM. One is arbitrage pricing theory. It doesn't do anything that the CAPM won't do. That doesn't mean the CAPM is perfect, but it's a damn good model. But the important thing to start with is that CAPM presses into service the systematic risk of a security relative to the market portfolio, beta. We measure that systematic risk of a security relative to the market portfolio by beta. Remember, a beta of 1 is the risk of the market portfolio. A beta of 0 would be a riskless or a risk-free asset. I'm going to just show you a few, some betas here, just to give you more of a feel for the concept of beta. But before I show you a bunch of them here, I do want to point out, I'm going to use the word security in a deeper way now. When I say a security, I don't necessarily mean a stock certificate or a bond certificate or something like that. An asset, for all intents and purposes, is a security. A project is a security. You pay something for it, and you expect something to come back for your investment. You are an asset. With respect to a company that hires you, you are nothing more and nothing less than money up front, money along the way, and an expected return for the investment made in you. Period. That's all you are. So I know that kind of degrades you. Don't worry, your family probably thinks of you as something more than that. Maybe your dog does. But for finance, we can't think in those terms. A project is an asset. A project is a prospective asset. We're looking at this as an asset we're going to buy. We are looking at it as a security. We are going to put money into the project, and we are going to hope to get money out of the project. As such, we can treat it, with some warnings along the way, some caveats, as a security. Hence, these betas have more significance than simply stocks and bonds. We can apply them, again with caution, to projects. So in other words, if I want to find the risk of a project that a company is taking on, I would want to find the discount rate to apply to future expected cash flows, I probably need to know a beta. How would I find a beta for a project? Well, one way that we do it, and I think I mentioned this, maybe I didn't, we would look at a company or a group of companies that do nothing but that kind of project. We would find their betas, take an average of them, and that could be the beta. We would consider the beta of our project for calculating discounted cash flows. But anyway, without further yakking here, here's some betas for different industries. These are and interestingly, this one was calculated in January of 2016. It's actually hard to find more fairly current data on anything in finance these days, and except stocks, prices, and all that. But I mean, I was going through and I was looking for different sources of beta. I found one. It was really great. Wow, this is a lot of data. And then I got clear to the bottom of the page. Let's check the copyright date, 1996. Well, alrighty then. That wasn't going to help me much. But this was January of 2016. So looking through this, and remember, these are industries, not individual companies. So there's going to be some risk suppression here because you're looking across more than one company to get an industry. Is there anything you notice about these betas? Let me run down the line here. But just running along, there are two things that I notice, and I don't know if you see them too, but I'm just going to run down here, just looking down on the beta column, which is the third column here. Anything you notice by any chance? Yes, I did. That was one of the two things I noticed. They more often than not, they're over one. The one, did you notice that one there at the bottom, utilities? Let me pull that, take it down there to the bottom. Utilities in general are safe assets. Because, I mean, everyone's going to need electricity and water. So, the risk that one of those kinds of companies is going to go tap city is fairly low. An interesting story about this. Beta was quickly embraced by financial analysts, by the academic community, by economists. And the attendant capital asset pricing model, CAPM. Now, in regulation of utilities, states regulate utilities. They determine for a utility a fair rate of return and for the company's investments and all of that. And then they set the rates that the utility can charge customers based upon this fair rate of return that the utility company should get. So that's how rate regulation works. Interestingly, it was in the mid-1970s, I think the first case was, where the regulators said, instead of this kind of like, we take whatever the utility company suggests and maybe we'll modify it a little, and then we'll apply that to determine the fair rate of return. Sort of, let's ask the foxes how they think we should put the locks on the hen house. Well, it was in the mid-70s that utility regulators began to apply the capital asset pricing model. Instead of just taking whatever the utility company said and taking whatever some advocates for the other side said and finding some happy medium, let's apply a scientific method, CAPM, to determine the K, the discount rate, for the or the required rate of return for the utility company. Well, the utility companies actually had a cow. Oh, God, no. And they went, I can't remember which state it was, but the utility company that was about to have the CAPM applied to, or was having the CAPM applied to it, took the state regulatory agency to court and said, Your Honor, we can't let this. This is some willy-nilly pie-in-the-sky academic airhead crap. We need the old way. We need to do it the old way. And they petitioned the court to forbid the regulators from using CAPM. Well, the court, being courts being conservative, as they must be, said they agreed with the utility company. Said, CAPM, what is that thing? Who ever heard of that before? It had already been out there 10 years, and it was already being applied by businesses all over the world. But the courts quickly threw out the use of CAPM by regulators to determine required fair rate of return. It wasn't until the 1980s that courts finally got the message, this is not some pie-in-the-sky idea. This is the model for finding required rates of return. It is best practices. But there you go. For as soon as the CAPM was hit, faced the world of courts, the courts rejected it right off the bat. Okay, the first thing you see is, yes, do you notice that a lot of these are above one? Yeah. Okay, what's the other thing you notice? I don't know, this is a little subtler, but is there anything else you see in here? Let me just go up and down it just a little bit. Just look at some of the betas. Both those above one and below one. Hey, look, there's a 1.0 right on the button. There's one really close. Diversified. Which makes sense. Diversified has a beta of 1.01. Well, that would be like a diversified portfolio. It's got a lot of different things in it, okay? Do you see anything else that kind of strikes you? And like I said, this is one's a little bit subtler.
All of the necessities.
Oh, that's obvious. I should have noticed that one. Yeah, you're right. I should have mentioned that one. Yes. If it's a necessity, it's going to be lower risk. Let me ask you, sir, do you use toilet paper? Bro, I do too. Okay, so we're good on that. I mean, hell could come to earth and we'll still buy our damn Charmin. Okay, the same is true for other necessities. Utilities are necessities, but that's the point is those are lower risk industries because they are robust to the economic circumstances of the moment. You will buy your toilet paper. I will buy my potato chips, damn it. But anyway, anything else you notice? Well, there's a, look at that one. Look at these two, office equipment and services. Man, those are high. Oil field services, well, duh, yeah. Speaking from experience in that industry. But if you take sort of the broad swath of them, you have more above one than below one. But do you notice that they are not hugely high? They cluster above one like a cloud in the 1.1 to 1.5 range, but most of them are in the 1.1 to 1.3 range. In other words, in a lot of cases, see, you got 1.33, 1.27, 1.11, 1.29, 1.18, 1.19, and then you get a couple that are spikers. They're up there higher. But for the most part, even below one, they tend to cluster around that beta of one in a cloud. Now, this is not true of individual companies. But once you get to the size of industries, you don't see too many industries that have extraordinarily high risk. I don't think I see anything in this anywhere in this. Did you see any that were two or above? Let me run up. There's one that's close. What the hell was that I just saw? Oh, tobacco. Well, duh. Tobacco, by the way, is a high-risk industry, but it's also high expected return because tobacco, of course, you have the potential for more of these giant, insanely large settlements against the tobacco companies. But it's also an exciting market because the United States is just one place. We can sell tobacco products other places in the world where they are not worried about lung cancer yet. So we can sell all the cigarettes we want into China, into Africa, into places where they don't have this health focus that we have here. And also, interestingly enough, another part of that is that the link of the correlation between, and it's not a causal connection, it's a correlation between heart disease, lung cancer, and the use of tobacco products, is somewhat characteristic of the United States. We do not see that tie as strongly in other parts of the world. So we don't see those as being prospective for high settlement payouts in the near future. So high risk, yes, but also high expected return in the tobacco industry. I'm sure I'll get some do-gooders going to listen to this podcast and send me some flaming, damning email.
Screw you.
Anyway, I'm doing... Construction, why has that got a high beta? Highly sensitive to the economy. Construction of new homes, construction of commercial properties goes up when times are good. It goes straight to hell in bad times. Being in the construction industry is a boom-bust kind of thing. The oil industry is a boom-bust kind of thing. That's why you see that oil, oil prices going up and down like we do. Where was the oil industry? Come on. Oil industry. Oil and gas. There you go. Look at these. Those are high betas. Oil field services, 1.74. Oil gas production and exploration, 1.63. Those are the kinds of industries that are boom and bust. And right now we are in a bust part of the cycle. It's great for you. You got low gas price, great for me too. But at the same time, if you're a wildcatter, this era just sucks terribly. So as far from the business side of it, it's definitely not a great era right now. Get prices back up there to $100 a barrel, $130 a barrel, and let the good times roll. But anyway, I do want you to have a sense of the betas and what they mean, because it is quite possible on the next exam or on the final, I could describe one of these betas or a couple of them and ask you, explain to me why this beta speculate. Why is this beta what it is? And no, whatever you say isn't going to be okay. You have to say things that make sense in a rational academic way that would be what a professional would say. So if I say, for example, I cite the, let me find one that's, some of these are not really all that obvious though, but computer peripherals, computers and peripherals has a beta of 1.33. That's actually a fairly high beta. Why would that be? Can you explain? Give me a speculation. If you're wrong, I'll just say you dumbass. But no, can you give me a speculation, sir? Can you give me a speculation on why that beta of computers and peripherals would be high? I mean, everybody uses computers, right?
I mean, I was thinking of like technologies like VR. It's kind of adapting to.
Yeah, you're
right.
The evolution is just so fast. You got companies, I can name you companies, computer companies that were here yesterday and gone today. Can you think of any companies that were in computers that you just don't see hardly at all anymore? They took an ass bath and they walked away. Can you think of any? Gateway is a great example. I mean, Gateway tried its best. It even had boxes with cow print on them. What that had to do with computers, I don't know. Were you supposed to milk the damn computer? But yeah, think about other ones. In the personal computers market, some of the 800-pound gorillas of another era, like IBM. Do any of you own an IBM laptop? Nope. You do? Oh, okay. My bad. Okay, I, bro, I'm sorry. Okay, you know, I'm disrespected. Do they still have that stupid ass wick in the middle? That was, no, there was a, IBM had this genius idea that in the middle of the keyboard would be a red button that would be your mouse to move around. I could never get that thing to work worth a darn, and I was always bumping it, and then I'd delete my whole work that I was doing. But yeah, it's one of those industries and peripherals. And think about, I mean, the whole thing with electronics. You buy a monitor. Okay, I am at the state of the art. I've got a 720p monitor. Well, I've got a 1080. Okay, I am state of the art. Well, you suck. You don't have a 2K. Well, you suck. You don't have a 4K. I know a guy who bought a 4K about 5 months ago, and now he's bitching because the next generation is coming out. So it is a really tough, it is a danger in that industry. And you've got some companies that just come roaring on the scene. They use their monopoly position to force their way into a market, and that creates volatility for other companies in it. Can anyone think of a monopoly in another part of the high-tech world, new world, that just muscled its way in a couple of years ago, and now it's well-known for its notebooks? Yeah? Well, That's one right there. I'm thinking of Google. Google Chrome, those Chromebooks, they're just all over the place now. So, you know, it's just God, it's an unpredictable industry. What's going on right now, I don't even think about that sector. But anyway, that's the backdrop, is the whole thing with the betas and getting a sense of what those betas tell you about an industry. And the next part, though, is the triumph itself, the capital asset pricing model, CAPM. It's a very simple model. It has three pieces to it. You are going to calculate the discount rate or the required rate, whatever you want to call it, for a security. Now remember, that could be a single stock, it could be a portfolio, it could be a project. But remember, what you're calculating is the expected return for bearing systematic risk. You don't get a reward for bearing unsystematic risk. So this expected return, K sub S, is the return you expect based upon the systematic, the non-diversifiable risk. So the parts of it, we're going to need the K sub F, the risk-free rate. Now, I think I mentioned this before. Let me zoom this a little bit. Back in the day, we would have said, okay, the risk-free rate is a theoretical animal. It's not something that we can directly visually observe. It's part of theory. The closest that we can come to it, which is virtually the thing, is the rate of return, the yield, the expected yield, on a short-term treasury instrument. We have almost always, since time immemorial, this is the way I was taught from the time I started taking classes, finance classes, clear through PhD program, the risk-free rate, the one you use, is the annualized rate on a three-month T-bill, or maybe the annualized rate on a six-month T-bill, or the yield on a one-year T-bill, short-term instrument. It is as close to risk-free as you can get. As I've said, you will get paid your money on a treasury bill. It's not going to default on you. However, that does not mean it is purely that yield is exactly the risk-free rate, because there is an infinitesimal possibility that a treasury bill would default. It's never going to happen. If it were going to happen, the government would just print more money like it always does. It could raise taxes, or we could make up some phony reason to invade a country and take away its money. We've done that too. But the bottom line is, there is still a theoretical possibility, as ridiculously minimal as it is, that a treasury instrument could default. That's why the yield on a three-month T-bill is not exactly the risk-free rate, the annualized yield on a three-month T-bill. It's not exactly the risk-free rate. But it is so close that, for all intents and purposes, it's what we use. Except, and I just really came to understand that this was going on maybe 5 years ago. And modern CAPM users are not using the annualized yield on a three-month T-bill. I mean, I always just kind of threw in the yield on a one-year T-bill. I knew I should use the three-month annualized, but I was lazy. And then I started seeing these analysts who were coming up with CAPM results that weren't mine. I thought, what the hell are they doing? And I talked to a couple, and they said, oh, you don't use those short-term T-bills for this. You use the annualized yield on a seven-year treasury note. What? Or a 10-year treasury bond. Why would you do that? Because those actually have a maturity premium in them. They don't have a default premium or a liquidity premium, but you've got an instrument that long, it's going to have a little bit of a maturity premium in it, for God's sake. That's what the yield curve is. Why are you using something that is clearly got has a risk premium that is above risk-free in it? The logic that they've told me, and I've gotten this enough that I kind of buy it, is that you're going to use CAPM to value assets. Essentially, you're going to find discount rates for projects, for stocks, for bonds, for things like that, for investments of all kinds. And the logic is this: none of those is going to be a three-month deal. All of the things that we use it for are long-term things. Projects. You're not going to use CAPM for a three-month project. You're not going to use CAPM for a lot of things that are very short term. So we would like to use a risk-free rate that is more in line with the time frame of projects. That's why you're seeing the risk-free rate being proxied by a seven-year treasury note or something like that. Fair enough. And I've actually gotten to the point where I'm comfortable with it and I'm doing it myself most of the time. You'll see on old exams of mine from finance 10 years ago, I would say, use a CAPM. Assume that the expected return to the market portfolio is blah, and the three-month annualized return to a treasury bill is. Anymore, I would probably say the annualized yield on a seven-year treasury note is. It's just, you just got to use what's the best practices, and that seems to be what the best practices are. Another thing that you're going to need for this model, and I don't write this exactly how the book does. The book uses all kinds of obtuse notation. You'll see me write K sub M. This is the expected return to the market portfolio. K sub M is the expected return to the market portfolio. In other words, if you held the market portfolio, what would you expect your annualized return to be on this? Historically, and I kind of went into this in an early lecture, and I'll just bring it up again. If you were to hold, when you're just a few years from now, you start buying securities, you get yourself a nice clean portfolio, you have a beta of one, you're trying to mirror the market itself. If you buy and hold, just reinvesting the dividends back into the portfolio as they come along. That's, by the way, one of the cool things about mutual funds. As dividends are paid by the stocks in your fund that you're investing in, they'll just plow those back into your portfolio. If you were to do that over a long period of time, and I were teaching you at the beginning of my teaching career, at the beginning of the 1980s, I would tell you that you would expect a return, a long-term return, of about 7%. Okay? About 7%. Buy and hold, just hold that son of a bitch. For your, don't shift it around, don't play with it, just let it go, making sure you keep it balanced, the portfolio balanced. You know, kick out stocks that disappear where they become minimal, put in stocks as the companies get bigger and the weight of the market and all that kind of stuff. 7%, buy and hold. Now, if you beta'd up, you know, to 1.5, that would mean that you should expect about a 10.5% return. Beta down to 0.5, you would get a 3.5% return. Okay, 7%. Teaching you right now, there's a part of the theory behind this. It's a mathematical theory. It's past finance. It's physics. It's the whole nine yards. But there, that theory has in it a parameter called Tobin's Q. And Tobin's Q is a constant of nature that drives what's that 7%. Interestingly enough, Tobin's Q, we are sure now that Tobin's Q has shifted. Probably in the late 90s, early 2000s, Tobin's Q shifted. It slid. It's caused, now I would tell you, that over a very long period of time, 5%, 6%. But because it looks like Tobin's Q has become fragile, Tobin's Q might slip again within 10 years, in which case 5% is going to be too optimistic for you. In other words, it sucks to be you. This is saying that Tobin's Q is shifting, at least when I was doing all this theoretical stuff in the 80s, learning all this. That'd be like saying that the constant E, or the speed of light, or Rydberg's constant, or pi, had shifted. It's just, you wouldn't say that, but it has, and it's probably, and it has, the effect of that is essentially to lower the long-term expected return to a buy-and-hold market portfolio, which is kind of, like I said, that kind of sucks. But, you know, there you go. Cat food isn't that bad in your old age. Okay, now the next thing, yeah, go ahead.
When you were talking about stocks and bonds, maybe a couple of weeks ago, you said when you invest in the market, you want an ideal beta of around 11% or 12%.
I want a beta of 11 or 12. Expected return? Oh no, that would be for the market itself. If I said that, I was saying it not quite correctly. I mean, that would be for a higher risk investor, you know, putting in your youth. There's nothing wrong with having a higher beta in your younger years. And in fact, a beta of one for someone your age, well, you're now, that's a little conservative, a little defensive for you because you have time to recover. So 10%, 12% isn't that bad. But part of that also was that we had a really exciting run-up in the stock market there for a few years. It's pretty much over with now, though. So there for a while, your expected return could be higher and still hold a beta of about 1.2 in your portfolio. However, the market has settled down, and so your expected return from here on out isn't going to be that good at all, even at 1.2, 1.3. And besides which, you look like you're getting to be a little older, so you got to back off that kind of stuff, go down to 1.0 and all that kind of stuff. But this wild and crazy guy, hell, he could handle 1.8, you know. Yeah, as a matter of fact, you should get one of those tattoos. Beta equals 1.8 forever. You know, show people just how radical you are. That's sad. That's humor that you actually understand it. Anyway, okay. The next thing is expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. This is called, and it's got a long name, and I don't think you're ever going to hear me use the long name. This is the expected market premium over risk-free. In other words, this is the extra reward you get for bearing the risk of the market instead of being a coward and investing in a treasury bill. It's your additional reward. You'll hear me call this the market premium. That's really kind of hiding the expected and the over risk-free. But you'll hear a lot of us in the industry will say the market premium. Be careful, because it sounds like a lot like the market portfolio. The market portfolio is K sub M. The market premium, what we're really doing is shortening the expected market premium over risk-free. So be careful. Those two things sound fairly similar, and I'll try to keep the distinction between them. But in the outside world there, if you're looking at websites that talk about market theory and practice, or if you're hearing some of the more sophisticated analysts on a television or radio show, they might say market premium, or they might say market portfolio. If they know what they're talking about, those two things would be different. The market portfolio might be 8%, but the market premium might be 6%. Because that the market premium would be the 8% minus 2% risk-free rate. Again, just be cautious. Market portfolio, that just means K sub M. Market premium, that's K sub M minus K sub F. And so we come to the Cap M, the capital asset pricing model. The discount rate for a security is going to be equal to the risk-free rate plus the beta of the security times the market premium, K sub M minus K sub F. That is Cap M. It is elegantly simple. I mean, it's one of the simplest models you'll see in science. It's a linear relationship. The variables, the independent variable will be the beta. That'll be the X. The dependent variable will be the K sub S. That'll be the Y. And the slope, and notice this. You remember the Y equals MX plus B. Well, this will be Y equals B plus MX. We write it in. The X will be the beta. The slope of this line will be the market premium. And the Y, notice the Y-intercept is the risk-free rate. Don't sweat that. It makes sense. I'm going to draw you a line. So look here. No, I can actually get it all on there. Okay, so in other words, the y-intercept of this linear equation is going to be the K sub F. That would be the return if the beta is zero. Look at the model. See, if I set beta equal to zero, then K sub S equals K sub F. Okay? If I set beta equal to one, if I set beta equal to 1, I've got K sub F plus K sub M minus K sub F. So beta equal to 1 is K sub M. The market, which of course makes all the sense in the world. It's almost like, well, duh, it should say that. Those are two points on a linear equation. So I can actually draw the line now. We have a name for this line. It is the line that shows the relationship between beta and expected return to the security. See that thing right there? That's called the capital market line. That's called the capital market line. In other words, on that line, I can say, oh, well, what about a beta of 0.5? Okay, I can see it right there. The problem is, well, it's not so much a problem, but I do want to point out that the capital market line is not static. It is a living animal. As K sub F changes, notice, if K sub F, if the risk-free rate changes, but nothing else changes, then the line just goes up parallel fashion. If beta changes, I'm sorry, if K sub M minus K sub F changes, in other words, if the relationship between the market portfolio return and the risk-free rate changes, the slope of this line will swing up or down. So in other words, if K sub F stayed the same, but the expected return to the market portfolio increased, then that would make the slope of the line increase, but leave the y-intercept the same. So the capital market line would swing upward, like that. If the K sub M stayed the same, but K sub F actually declined, actually two things would happen. If K sub F declined, then what would happen is that the line would slide down because the y-intercept had dropped. But it would also, because K sub M minus K sub F got bigger, it would also pivot upward. So in other words, K sub F going down would actually have two effects. Now, you have to think about this. Maybe doodle it out on a napkin or something while you're eating. Or if you got really good toilet paper, you know, scratch it out while you're on the toilet some night. But as you begin to work with this, you begin to see... that this is a way that we can see what interest rates and expected returns do in an economy. And that's why I'm going to take you over to this very extremely cool website and show you some interesting stuff on it. The black line here, okay, let me explain this. The green line is K sub F. It's a proxy for K sub F, okay? The blue line is K sub M, the actual expected return to the market portfolio. So, and K sub M minus K sub F is the black line. See how if I take the blue line at a point minus the green line at a point, I would get the black line at that point. So the green line is K sub F. The blue line is K sub M. The black line is K sub M minus K sub F. So in other words, the black line is showing you the slope of the capital market line. Let me make sure you see that. That black line is K sub M minus K sub F, which is the slope of the capital market line. So as that black line goes up, the slope of the capital market line pivots upward. Now, I want to point out something to you here very quickly. I'm going to work with this here in a minute, but I want to show you one more thing real quickly. Suppose that the capital market line pivots upward. Suppose that it pivots upward. Look at what that does to the required rate of return on projects. Whereas, let's say we had a project with a beta of 0.8. Before the capital market line pivoted upward, the slope increased. The discount rate was this for it, the required rate of return. But after the swing upward, do you see how the required rate of return has increased on the project? The required rate of return has increased on the project. Which, in other words, would make it less likely that you would get a positive NPV on the project, interestingly enough. So, in other words, what we're looking at in that black line is essentially a measure of how much risk projects will show up, what required rate of return will show up. Higher the higher the K sub M minus K sub F, the less likely a given project will cross a hurdle rate, the less likely that a given project will have a positive NPV. You remember that, okay? Because I will ask something about that on exam two. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Okay? Can you write that out? Can you write that out? Let me say it. Yeah.
So this tells you, I guess, the breaking point.
Yeah. You remember we talked about hurdle rates? Now, think about, okay, you had a project that had a hurdle. You have a project that has, let's say it comes up with an internal rate of return of 8%. Okay? Now, your hurdle rates are, let's say, 7%. Okay, great. No problem at all. You're going to take this project. But at the same time, if that beta, or rather, if that project, you calculate cap M, and you find a higher required rate of return, you're not going to use 7% anymore. You're going to use 9%, 10%. Taken another way, and this comes back to what you're asking me to repeat what I said before. Suppose that I use cap M, and I came up with a discount rate of, let's say, 7%. So I apply that, and I calculate the NPV, and the NPV is just barely positive. Okay? Okay, now the capital market line has pivoted upward. That would mean that the K sub S that I calculate would be a bigger number, right? Okay. If I apply a bigger number to calculate the net present value, it's quite likely that if it was barely positive before, it's going to be negative now, and I'll reject the project. Projects will essentially come in with lower net present values the higher the discount rate is that you use on them. Again, this is back from a couple of chapters ago. Projects will come in with lower net present values the higher the discount rate is you use. If cap M starts spitting out higher and higher discount rates that you have to apply to calculate NPVs, in other words, that means that you're going to have more projects that you reject. That's why we care about that black line that I'm going to show you again here. Because as that black line goes up, that's the K sub M minus K sub F. And if that's going up, then the K sub S on the other side of the cap M is going to be more likely to fail. Look at this right here. The capital asset pricing model. If K sub M minus K sub F goes up, that means that this whole right side of the equation is going to be bigger. That means the K sub S on the left side is going to be bigger, which means that when I throw a bigger number in to calculate NPV, I'm more likely to get a negative NPV on the project. That's why the black line that I'm about to bring back up matters. As that black line goes down, we'll accept more projects. As that black line goes up, we'll reject more projects. And so, without further ado, let's bring it back to that line. Oh, yeah. Part of what I'm doing in this course is I'm not just spitting out, I want to flunk you, obviously, on information, regurgitating formulas, but I want you to think, why am I doing this? Why does this matter to you? And this does because your sorry asses are going to be out there looking for jobs here in a while, okay? Remember, I told you that you are just an investment. You're a security. So if discount rates go up, then that means that you are more likely to be a negative net present value project for a company, so they won't hire you. That should matter to you. Well, unless you're independently rich, which I suspect you are, your problem. But I don't know. Look at the slope of the capital market line. See the black line? K sub M minus K sub F was skyrocketing. which meant that the discount rates that were being applied to projects were making net present values that were negative all over the place. Hence, we had the Great Recession. Look at that son of a bitch. It just spiked there. And notice that it went on a roller coaster here. See how it was rolling high in here too? That's why the Great Recession was the Great Recession. Discount rates applying the cap M, case of M minus case of F, was big, which meant that the case of S that we were using for discounting cash flows for net present to calculate net present values, we're going to come up with discount rates that knock net present values into negative territory. Hence, you don't invest in projects. You don't invest in capital equipment. You don't invest in new employees. Hell, you don't even invest in R&D in that kind of a situation. Now, I want you to come back to here. Look at the era, the period right here. You see how that black line was really stable from 2003 to 2000, up approaching 2008? You see how stable it was? You look like a wild and crazy guy. Really, you know, you probably have, your nickname is Ace. You've got a Harley hiding in a garage. And at night you put on leather and you drive around making really, really creepy eyes at girls and all that kind of stuff. But you're going to be a businessman. We don't like excitement. We don't like volatility. You hear these gurus on finance shows, volatility is a friend of an investor. No, you idiot. That's just because you use meth. We don't like excitement. We don't like unpredictability. We like to see what's in front of us. Okay? You see, it's that whole thing about if we have little problems, little flies, you know, a lot of little, and you know, we can see past the flies. Those are the annoyances of the day, little disturbances in our lives. But then all of a sudden, you have this giant dragon. Wait a minute. Fire breathing dragon. You can't see past it. Okay? I don't know what the hell that was all about, but the point I'm making is that in business, we don't want that wildness. You know, we can be research, we can do, take risks with our research, with our products if we want to, but at the same time, we don't like this risk that's out there that we can't control. We don't like whipsaws up and down. We like a stable environment. And that's one of the things about, you hear this talk about higher taxes, lower taxes. Actually, if you're a moderate business person, you say, shut the hell up, both of you. You give us a tax system, a tax setup, and leave it the frick alone so that we have predictability. You talk about economic policy. Don't get fancy. Don't go stirring up wars that we get caught into. But at the same time, don't suddenly have the welfare program of the day. Just give us stability in the macro economy. That's what helps us as business people. We can be crazy and wild in our personal lives, but in business, we don't much care for that. And that stability that we had there was a good thing. Now, I can say all I want about the bad economic, the bad problems that were showing up during the second, especially the second term of the Bush administration. And you can see, do you see what was scary, getting me all kinds of excited as we were approaching 2008? In the early months of 2008, why one of the reasons I was screaming something is going to go really wrong here. Do you see what was happening? Look at the volatility. Look at the higher. I mean, by the time we get to the the apocalypse in September of 2008. The apocalypse, it was already happening, but no one could see it. I mean, the die had already been set for a really bad situation. Case of M minus case of F was just spiking like a mofo. That's a technical term. Okay, damn it. Because the market portfolio expectation was high. The Fed was suddenly peeing all over itself because it had caused a lot of this with its crushing of the M1 for so long. So it was tanking the interest rate, the risk-free rate with open market operations, expansionary open market operations. But that was a bad situation there. Case of M was going up, case of F was going down. So in that kind of a situation, well, there you go. You got all the makings for a serious zombie apocalypse. Now, you see the volatility? See it? The Fed was cutting interest rates rapidly, but the market, the expected return of the market portfolio was showing strength, principally because the Fed was printing money, but that money printing was going into the hands of very powerful investment banks and commercial banks. And so it was, they were just throwing that money into the stock markets, which was why the stock markets just kept skyrocketing. So the market portfolio was not cooling off very well at all. The risk-free rate was tanking down to nearly 0% at one point. And that's why we had that protracted, very difficult climb out of the recession. Companies weren't investing. Unemployment was still staying high. But then, look, stability, again, and hence why you saw the good economic numbers last year and a half, 2 years. But here is what's scary. The end. Do you see it? This is February. March should be coming out soon. But the implied the risk-free rate, 1.74. The expected return to the market portfolio, 7.01. 7.01 minus 1.74 is the case of M minus case of F. The 5.27. Okay, you understand it? I'm putting this into real terms of the market itself here. Case of M minus case of F. Case of M, 7.01. Case of F, 1.74. Case of M minus case of F, 5.27. Remember the capital market line, though. Watch. Watch the case of M minus case of F. It's been on a roller coaster. You see it? Do you see how there's a trend upward in it that's really scary? Case of M minus case of F is getting bigger. That's swinging the capital market line up, meaning that for a given beta, the required rate of return is going up, which means that the probability of a rejection on NPV grounds is increasing for a project, whether they be capital projects, investments in R&D, or hiring your butt out of college. That is what you're looking at. It's, again, I just don't like the trend. The volatility and that spike there, you got a real nasty two-month spike there on these last 2 months. That's telling me that we've got a problem building. A longer-term problem is that notice that the whole black line was considerably lower, case of M minus case of F. And then, Jesus, God almighty. Okay, see how the case of M minus case of F, the black line, back in the 2000, early 2000s, 3.79, 3.92, 3.41, see how small it is? You get past the Great Recession, and even at its best, the black line, 4.4, 4.3, 4.2, 4.0, 4.71, and then 4.93, 5.27. That's bad news. It's been higher than it was in the early, in the first half of the first decade of the 21st century. It's been staying above where it was, and now it's starting to show some teeth. That is that dragon floating out there, getting in the way of our planning horizons. Because, let me do one real quick here. Right now, we have, hang on here. Let me take you back here to right to here. June of 2014. The case of F, what was the case of F? The case of F is 2.53. The case of M is 6.75. And case of M minus case of F is 4.22. That's 2014. Now let's write them down, 2016. Case of F, bring it over to here. Case of F is 1.74, a little lower. Case of M, 7.01. Case of M minus case of F is still a little lower. Well, no, it's 5.27. Okay. Put it into the grinder. Let's switch over here to the document camera now. Let's say that we're looking at a project that has a beta of 1.2. Applying the case of S, the discount rate to calculate NPV, case of F plus beta times case of M minus case of F. Walking it through. Case of S. In 2014, that project would have come in, would have been 2.53 plus 1.2 times case of M minus case of F, 4.22. Taking it over here, it would be 1.74 plus 1.2 times 5.27. Let's see what happened. The y-intercept has slipped some for the first one. PC, and get the calculator back up here. Where the hell is calculator? The first one, 2.53 plus 1.2 times 4.22. That'd be a 7.59% discount rate we would apply to the project to calculate the NPV. Now let's do it for 2016. In this case, we would do 1.74 plus beta 1.2 times, in this case, it would be the market premium is 5.27, 8.06. See it? Higher probability of rejecting the project. You apply the 7.59% to the project, get an NPV. You go back and do it with 8.06, you'll get a lower NPV, possibly a negative. In other words, there is evidence. It is definitely preliminary. Don't get me wrong. I'm not calling for the zombie apocalypse and you having to do your cardio and your double tap and all that. But at the same time, there is definitely a bias upward in the probability of rejecting projects, whether they are capital projects, research and development, or hiring new employees fresh out of college. The only thing you have going for you, and you should thank your God for this, you have had the best finance professor who has ever walked the face of the earth. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.